songwriter, poet, and now Nobel laureate today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Bob Dylan wins the Nobel for Literature. A big surprise, but Dylan's global influence is undeniable.
All over the world, people know who Bob Dylan is, and people know that his music was a force for change, a force for protest, a way of thinking a new world is possible.
And speaking of new worlds, Japanese writers on what a Trump presidency might mean.
Collapsing America, the world will go mad if there's a President Trump. And Trump fever, America's anti-intellectualism.
Plus, the Chinese rule at wine tasting, so take their advice on pairing with a glass of red.
I'll go a bit creative. I'll give you fatty braised pork.
All today, here on The World. Thanks for being here today. It is a busy day. The king of Thailand has died, leaving the future in question there. The streets of Venezuela continue to surge with anger, the future also in question there. And speaking of unpredictable, Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature, which is where we start the show today. He joins the ranks of Ernest Hemingway and Toni Morrison, Pearl Buck and John Steinbeck, other Americans who've won the Nobel for Literature. But I'm also reminded of all the artists around the planet we featured on The World, musicians we've called the Bob Dylan of fill in the name of any country. As a poet, and that's how the Nobel Committee assessed Dylan, he did offer a different way of writing lyrics. But today there are as many people saying this was a weird choice as there are those who say it's a great choice, and so we want to know why. Peter Dreyer writes about politics and teaches at Occidental College in Los Angeles. What are your thoughts of Bob Dylan as a Nobel laureate?
Well, Bob Dylan caught the spirit of the 1960s when he came into Greenwich Village from Minnesota, and it was the time of the Civil Rights Movement and the beginning of the anti-war movement and the rebellion of the baby boom. And he was right there singing and writing about those issues. Most of the things he wrote on a political topic happened in his first 5 or 6 years when he was living in Greenwich Village and caught up in the spirit of what was going on in the South. He went down to Mississippi to sing for civil rights workers. He was often present at anti-war rallies. And then in the late 60s, he began to take a turn and said, I don't want to be political anymore. I'm no longer a protest singer. But it doesn't really matter what Dylan thinks he was. The spirit of his music continues today. Whenever there's talk about rebellion and protest, always in the background, we're hearing blowing in the wind and the times are changing. And so Bob Dylan's legacy lives on, even though he denies he was a singer of protest songs.
So last year, the Nobel awarded the Literature Prize to Svetlana Alexievich, a book she wrote about Russians returning from the war in Afghanistan. I mean, we know what her intent was. Dylan is notoriously reluctant to talk about his lyrics. So do we really know who he is?
Well, some of his lyrics are actually quite specific. In his early days, he wrote a song, for example, about the killing of Emmett Till, a 15-year-old African-American boy who was killed by white thugs in Mississippi. But in general, like you said, his music is much more ephemeral. But in his early days, people knew what he meant. When Blowing in the Wind came out, it was made popular by Peter, Paul, and Mary, not by Dylan. People knew that it was about the war in Vietnam and about the bombs and about how many deaths will it take before we can hear people cry. People heard Bob Dylan, even if Bob Dylan wasn't telling us who he was.
When students in Paris and around the globe were protesting in the streets in 1968, they broke out acoustic guitars. That wasn't a coincidence, was it?
Oh, absolutely not. No, the folk craze was due in part to Pete Seeger and in part to Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and other people. But it was Dylan who caught everyone's imagination. So in the early 1970s, when the military coup in Chile took place, the person we remember from that period is Victor Jara, who was considered the Bob Dylan of Chile. And as you said in your opening, in every country in the world where there's protest and rebellion, there is someone or some groups of people that are called the Bob Dylan of that country because he is an iconic figure. And so now that he's won the Nobel Prize for Literature, perhaps even more people will have heard of him.
Yeah, where else around the globe have you seen Dylan's influence as a protest singer, that kind of icon?
Well, certainly in South Africa during the battle over apartheid, certainly in the Soviet Union during the dismantling of the communist government, certainly in China during the Tiananmen Square battle. All over the world, people know who Bob Dylan is, and people know that his music was a force for change, a force for protest, a way of thinking a new world is possible.
Let me just put this to you, Peter. The voice of the cynics today would say we rely on the Nobels to introduce us to overlooked writers. The choice of Dylan was a facile one made by aging baby boomers who, like the Oscar voters and Martin Scorsese, felt that Bob Dylan's time had come.
Well, I think he's well-deserving of the award. I think the Nobel Prize committee isn't just aging baby boomers. It's people that recognize that he's a historical figure and in his own time. And when he's gone, people will remember his music, people will remember his lyrics, and people will remember the spirit that he embodied.
Peter Dreyer, historian at Occidental College in Los Angeles. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Marco.
As I mentioned earlier, Thailand's king of Bhumibol Adulyadet died today, which means a delicate transition is now underway in Bangkok. King Bhumibol was officially Thailand's head of state, but many Thais revered him as a deity as well. He became king in 1946 as an 18-year-old and held on to his throne for more than 70 years. The World's Patrick Nguyen is in Bangkok. He's going to tell us how Thais are reacting to this news. But what he's able to say is also limited by strict local laws regarding the monarchy.
In Thailand, anyone who defames the palace can be sent to jail for up to 15 years. And defaming in this context, it doesn't mean exactly what most listeners probably think it means. It can be anything short of high praise. It's a very strict law.
Okay, we're going to follow up on those laws in a moment, but give us the latest. How are people reacting to the passing of the king today?
It's pretty surreal and somber. Thailand has now gone into a period of mourning that will last 1 year, and typically that means wearing black clothing during that period of mourning. You know, nightlife here, as you know, can be pretty intense, but all that flashy neon stuff is closed down. And any sort of celebratory activity will be toned down for the foreseeable future.
I saw one short video clip allegedly from the palace and the people who work there. I mean, just tears. I mean, everybody sobbing.
Yeah, I cannot overstate the intensity of emotion right now. I would actually view this event in a quasi-religious light because many Thai people have treated the king as if he is quasi-divine. I mean, I'll try and make sense of this. You know, if you've grown up in Thailand, the king ruled for 70 years. If you've grown up in Thailand, you've bowed before his picture in school. You see his image on TV every day. You see his face on your money. There are gilded golden signs with his face hanging over almost every street. And you are told that basically the king is a paragon of virtue and he's at the pinnacle of Thai society. So this is really driven home from birth to all Thai people to revere the king. And they haven't been able to plan for this publicly. As I mentioned, there are laws preventing people from speaking openly about this day, this long-dreaded day. So people have not been talking about this in coffee shops and on the street. So it feels, as I said, it feels very surreal.
A whole year of mourning, though, and that kind of shows just the degree to which this is, a major deal. Are you seeing flowers or any vigils happening? I mean, what does this look like in the streets?
I was at a grocery store earlier and saw that numerous people were crying, rushed home, and heard the announcement on TV from the prime minister where he announced that the nation would be plunged into mourning for a year. What I'm seeing online is that people throughout the country are sobbing, weeping, holding up the king's picture, thrown into intense states of grief. And that is going to last for some time.
How is the news media handling the death of the king?
There's a difference between how the local media and the foreign media are handling it. The local media, extremely reverent. You will even see some newspaper websites in Thailand that have turned their homepages monochrome out of respect, sort of in a funereal nature. Foreign media, of course, are looking ahead and wondering what this is going to mean for Thailand.
Are there plans for succession?
There are. The presumed heir to the throne is a prince. His name is Wajiratlongkorn, and his full title is hard to translate, but it includes the honorific Great Lord of the Skies, which is apt because he is an avid pilot. You know, what can I say? His father is so venerated as this glowing golden idol of perfection who's ruled for 70 years, and I don't know how anyone can live up to that, especially in the age of Facebook and Twitter. You know, there are these digital forces in every country that really delight in taking on entrenched elites. So it will be an interesting time for Thailand.
The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. We're going to leave it there. Thanks very much for the update.
Thanks, Marco.
King Bhumibol was not just the longest reigning monarch in modern history. He was the longest reigning monarch to be born in the United States. Yes, here in Massachusetts, about a mile from the studio. Sholtana Kurujna has been chronicling the king's early life here. She calls herself Shol and works as a computer scientist in the Boston area. She learned about the king's birthplace when she came here to study in the 1980s, and it got her wondering.
Why was he born here? That interests me. So I start researching, and I found so many interesting stories about his family.
Shol is now president of the King of Thailand Birthplace Foundation. Over the years, Shol and her researchers have located 11 spots around Massachusetts that have a special place in Thai history, and they've marked them with plaques.
The first plaque in West Chop.
That's West Chop on Martha's Vineyard, where the Thai royal family vacationed in 1926.
The second one at the hospital.
That would be Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge, where the baby who would become King Bhumibol was born the following year.
And then in Gloucester, and now we know.
Shol has been arranging for plaques to be placed wherever the royal family stayed.
We have 7 plaques all together right now.
The plaques tell the story of the late king's father, Prince Mahidon. The prince came to Massachusetts to study 100 years ago in 1916. He was the first Thai royal to attend university in the U.S. His mission was nothing short of bringing modern medicine back home to Thailand. When he and his wife returned to their country in 1928, he had a medical degree from Harvard, and she was a trained nurse, and they brought a wealth of knowledge that helped to modernize public health in Thailand. Shol takes pride in a plaque she placed on an apartment building at 63 Longwood Avenue. It's just down the street from Harvard Medical School and many of Boston's hospitals, and the family home where the future king spent the first 2 years of his life. Shol says Thai people from across the U.S. often come here. A young Thai man from Chicago brought his mother to visit the home and later told Shol about it.
His mother sat down on the ground and prayed and cried badly because she was so happy that once in her lifetime she get the chance to stand on the soil that the king of Thailand was born.
Sholtana Kurujna, like other Thais around the world, is now in mourning. She expects in the coming days many people will be stopping and looking at the plaques she's placed around Boston and learning about the first days of the late King Bhumibol. You're tuned to The World. I bet everyone listening right now has an opinion about Donald Trump. Kind of hard not to, even if you're undecided. But let's hear what they make of Trump over in Japan. And one way to gauge that, check out the onslaught of books about the Republican nominee that are showing up on Japanese shelves. Anna Fifield has checked them out. She's the Washington Post correspondent in Tokyo.
When I searched on Japanese Amazon, I found more than 24. The titles include things like Collapsing America, The World Will Go Mad If There's a President Trump, and Trump Fever, America's Anti-Intellectualism. You can guess the kind of tone that the books are going to take, but there's also a few books that treat it as a comedic kind of exercise.
Of these several dozen books, I mean, that's kind of extraordinary alone, just a number. Are they generally in support of Trump or do they kind of warn of Trump?
I have to confess that we did not read all like 25 books. We read a few of them. But generally, they were by and large worried, concerned about what a President Trump would mean for Japan.
You mentioned that one title, Collapsing America, The World Will Go Mad If There Is a President Trump. That's by an author named Kumi Yokoe. She tries to explain the Trump phenomenon in the U.S. How does she go about doing that?
Ms. Yokoe had studied in the U.S. and had been a fellow at a conservative think tank in Washington. So she had some understanding of what had been going on in the U.S. And so she was trying to explain about the Obama presidency, and particularly to explain to Japanese readers who by and large think that President Obama has been a weak president, that in fact he had brought in a lot of change in the US, like Obamacare and gay marriage had been legalized across the US. And so she was trying to say that this is partly a reaction to the achievements of the Obama presidency, and this is why people who were opposed to him were now supporting Donald Trump.
So that's kind of an explanation about how we got to candidate Trump. I know there's also a lot of underlying worry and anxiety about what will happen to Japan if Donald Trump gets elected. What are Japanese most anxious about?
Japan politically is a conservative country. The Conservative Party has been in power for all but four of the last 61 years. Been used to feel most comfortable working with Republican administrations in the US because Republicans have always been deemed to be strong on security and defense and very much in favor of the security alliance which the US has had with Japan since the end of the Second World War. And now Donald Trump has gone and put the cat amongst the pigeons here because he has been saying repeatedly on the campaign trail that we're losing billions of dollars to Japan because, you know, we're defending them. Japan's a rich country. They should be defending themselves, suggesting that he would bring an end to this security alliance. This has got people really worried in Japan, what this would mean for Japan's defense. And at the same time, North Korea is firing off all these missiles, right, conducting nuclear tests and doing all these things partly aimed at Japan. So there's a lot of nervousness about all this change happening at once.
Well, as you know, Anna, this is a time when Donald Trump's past deeds are being dredged up. It's just a few weeks before the vote, and now similar past deeds are also emerging, I gather, in these books. So one book, President Trump and the Truths of the U.S., goes really deep, and there's one story of a Japanese real estate investor who was a big gambler and played baccarat at the Trump Taj Mahal when it's still in business in Atlantic City. What is that story, and is it sourced out?
It's not sourced out. There were just kind of rumors at the time. So in this book, the writer goes through and looks at some of Donald Trump's interactions with Japanese people over the course of his career. And he tells the tale of this real estate investor who lost a lot of money at this Trump casino, like you said, and then came back to Japan and apparently was not able to pay his debts. He was found dead in Japan and the case was never solved. There were rumors at the time linked to the Japanese mafia here, but basically it was also linked to Donald Trump because these debts could be traced back to losing all this money there. So none of this has ever been borne out. There was no conviction in the case. Just these Japanese authors have been looking for all the links to Japan that Donald Trump may have had over the years.
Is the average Japanese person really following the U.S. election that closely, or is this maybe just a temporary publishing boom that'll end after November 8th?
People everywhere are following this election very closely. I mean, what happens in the US has a big influence on the rest of the world, and especially on these countries like South Korea and Japan that have security alliances with the US. I was surprised to see that TV channels in both Japan and South Korea broadcast the debates live with simultaneous translation. There is a lot of interest in what happens next month.
Anna Fifield with The Washington Post in Tokyo. Always good to speak with you, Anna. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco. You too.
A book for just about every political taste, it seems. Let's talk taste for wine for a moment, because we've had a thunderbolt in the world of wine. That's how the organizers of a major wine tasting competition in France describe the result. The winners were not French, Italian, or American. They were Chinese. I asked my colleague Vincent Ni about this. He's with the BBC's Chinese service.
Basically, this Chinese team won this blind tasting title, and they even beat the French, and French was ranked second, and the US was ranked third.
How does a tasting competition actually work?
Well, according to French media reports, these 21 teams were asked to identify six white wines and six red wines without seeing the bottle or the labels, and the Chinese team identified everything. And when asked how did they actually do it, the Chinese team was actually very modest. They say, you know, it was 50% of their knowledge and 50% of their luck.
Wow. Okay, so kind of self-deprecation there on how they won, but take us deeper into why you think the Chinese team was so well prepared.
Well, I actually think, you know, that the Chinese wine tasting habit was actually fairly new. It was a matter of time until China really, you know, got very rich and people started to appreciate different kind of fine wines, especially those from Europe. You know, French wines were sold in China as a symbol of middle class, and Italian wines were also sold in China as a kind of a lifestyle. So that the Chinese started to get used to this kind of, you know, consumption of wine with their Western counterparts.
I mean, we used to think that wine only came from France and Italy and that they were the only judges of wine, good or bad. So what do you think this news tells us about wine and globalization?
Well, it's quite interesting, Marco. You know, 40 years back in China, in the 70s or late 60s, when you want to, you know, have a glass of French wine, you will even be punished by the government. And this is labeled as the bourgeoisie lifestyle. So that was obviously during the Cultural Revolution. Mm. And when China started to open up, as a consequence, people started to get richer in China. And they started to travel around and then they see, wow, this is a whole new world of wine in Europe. And then they started to import. They even started to make wines in China. So this globalization makes it easier for people to connect with each other. Obviously, in terms of, you know, wine in China, because of globalization, they started to consume more.
So, Vincent, you confess that you are not a wine connoisseur, but let's say I give you a kind of a light red wine. What Chinese dish would go best with it?
Well, I'll go a bit creative. I'll give you fatty braised pork.
Oh, I love it. How'd you know I love fatty braised pork?
Because I think it's also a favorite dish of Chairman Mao.
Well, I guess that makes me the chairman today. My colleague Vincent Ni, editor with the BBC Chinese Service, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You are listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad trained as a doctor. Now he's embroiled in a long and brutal civil war. This man who studied with Assad says Syria's leader has forgotten the Hippocratic Oath.
As a physician, you treat the friends and the enemies and you save lives. Definitely, his actions are the opposite of that.
That story ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There is no let-up for the people of Aleppo. There were more airstrikes and bombings today in Syria's largest city. The death toll from the violence there just this week is now 150, and conditions in the city continue to deteriorate. Dr. Farida is the only female obstetrician left in the besieged eastern section of Aleppo. For security reasons, she uses only her first name. We reach her today at the hospital. She told us she usually walks to work because gasoline is in short supply. But this evening, the hospital sent a car for her. It drove without its headlights on.
I came here without any lights because the warplane was bumping in the streets. And so the driver told me we have to go without any lights. No, any car in Aleppo can make the light on, because when the airplane see any moving lights, he will bump them or with heavy artillery or with guns, with the heavy guns.
The danger isn't over when she gets there. Hospitals are now airstrike targets in Aleppo. But Dr. Farida brings her 7-year-old daughter to work with her every day. She says there's only one other family left in the apartment building where she lives, and she doesn't want to leave her daughter alone.
It's very bad. We feel alone. I feel alone. My mother and my dad, my brothers, all is out. No one stay in Aleppo. There's no electricity and no cars. Aleppo was the city who was not going to sleep. The people was always in the street, going to markets, go to swim, go to everything. Now it's a ghost city.
One physician here in the U.S. who works closely with Dr. Farida is Syrian-American Dr. Zaher Salul. He's a critical care specialist at Christ Advocate Medical Center in Chicago. Salul has gone on 5 medical mission trips to Syria since the war there began. He's deeply impressed with Dr. Farida's commitment to remain in Aleppo.
She's an amazing person. You know, her colleagues, you know, says that she's equal to 1,000 men. And when you hear that in Aleppo from this conservative society speaking about women, I mean, that speaks volume about the strength and the leadership of this woman. Her husband is an eye specialist also, and she has one small daughter. Her main concern is her patients. She was telling me just last week that she started to use home threads to suture her patients who have C-sections because she's running out of surgical sutures. And she said she's going to stay as long as she can, and even with the risk on her life and her family.
You were born and raised in Syria, Dr. Selul. You had your medical education there. In fact, you and Bashar al-Assad were classmates from 1982 to 1988. Tell us what his reputation was during those medical school days.
He was humble, not arrogant, wasn't perceived as brutal or ruthless. Some people, especially his close friend, thinks that he cheated his way in the exams. But other than that, nothing really special was about him.
So after getting a degree in Damascus, Assad moved to London in 1992 to specialize in ophthalmology. And he spent many years abroad and returned to Syria to take the helm after his older brother died. And after he'd moved into the palace, he'd invite doctors like you to gatherings there. Tell us about your first meeting with Assad after he became president in 2002.
In the first year after he became a president, he invited us, a group of us, to meet with him in the very impressive presidential palace in the top of the mountain overseeing Damascus. You don't feel that you're in a country in the Middle East. It looked like Switzerland from the gardens around the palace. It was best marble I've ever seen inside. And he greeted us warmly. We were a group of 10. His wife also met with our spouses. And he talked for 2 hours about his vision about Syria. He doesn't sound as presidential when he talks. And sometimes, you know, his talk is very boring. You know, some of my friends were yawning. But anyway, I asked him this question about introducing political reforms to Syria because, you know, I came from the United States and he was educated in the UK and people expected some opening in the political system. And at that time, it was called Damascus Spring. And he had this very long answer about the Syrian society and how tribal it is and how sectarian it is. And then he told me, well, Syrians are not ready for democracy.
When he said that, what did you think? And what did you think specifically about the future of Syria?
My friends told me that I'm not going to sleep in my house because I asked that question. They told me they're going to end up in the prison. But luckily, nothing like that happened. But people expected some openness in the system. You know, we had a large number of educated people in Syria, huge middle class, and people were yearning for some of the freedoms that we enjoy in this country.
It's kind of extraordinary. There are all these doctors in the Syrian diaspora, you included. Do you all kind of see Bashar al-Assad, also a doctor, not practicing, but do you see him in the same light?
You know, he crossed many lines that doctors should not cross. You know, he swore the Hippocratic Oath, graduation ceremony, which we all attended, which implies that as a physician, you treat the friends and the enemies and you save lives. Definitely, his actions are the opposite of that. You know, he also, his regime targeted doctors and nurses. More than 750 doctors and nurses were killed in the last 5 years. Many hospitals were destroyed, mostly by his regime. And this is the opposite of being a physician or a humanitarian. I wanted him to look at the eyes of the patients I've seen in Aleppo, the young children who were pulled out from the under the rubble of their houses, and some of them died, some of them were lucky.
You know, we read all these stories and see these images of people living through such enormous tragedy. Some people say we're just seeing the limits of American power and what this country can do. So what can we Americans who are watching, what do you want us to do?
Every citizen has a responsibility, I believe. I mean, this is the American values that, you know, I am proud that right now it's part of me, that we can organize, we can pressure our policymakers to do something. We have two moms in Chicago, Wendy and Becky, who organized this social media campaign called Stand with Aleppo. And they are urging average citizens who are not connected to Syria anyway to do their part by spreading the word and the pictures and the stories and contacting the president to do something. And I think each one of us should do something like that. Churches, synagogues, mosques should organize drives to donate to Syria and to the Syrian people. What's happening in Syria is affecting us, the anti-refugee sentiment, the xenophobia, the rhetoric that we are hearing right now here in the election season. Extremism, all of this is related to what's going on in Syria, and we have to stop this genocide. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, as Martin Luther King says.
Dr. Salul, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco, for having me.
Dr. Zahir Salul is a critical care specialist at Christ Advocate Medical Center in Chicago. He travels frequently to Syria. He was in Aleppo last July. Many in the West blame Russia for much of the death and destruction in Aleppo. That's because Russia is supporting the Syrian regime's offensive on the city. Russian and Syrian warplanes bomb targets in Aleppo on a daily basis. My BBC colleague Lise Doucette talked about that with Vitaly Churkin. He's Russia's ambassador to the United Nations. Churkin is unapologetic for Russia's military actions in Aleppo, although he does compare it to the U.S. carpet bombing of Hanoi during the Vietnam War, as you'll hear in a minute.
You see the photographs of the children. You see the photographs of the hospital.
I do.
Do you yourself look at them?
I do.
The children.
I do. And this is a very... But first of all, if they somehow were affected by our military campaign, of course, we regret it incredibly. And this is a heavy burden on our psyche and our soul if we are there and our military are fighting there. But this is what happens.
Is there any way to limit civilian casualties and still...
We are trying our best. We are trying to do our best. And our military have said repeatedly how careful they are about selecting...
It's indiscriminate, Ambassador Churkin.
Well, Hanoi bombing was indiscriminate.
Well, but that doesn't justify it.
Yeah, no, I agree. But what tells you that this is indiscriminate? You know, they are hitting Nusra targets which are in the city or like opposition groups who are associated with Nusra. I've not heard about any carpet bombing of eastern Aleppo. So if there is bombing and if some civilians are hurt, it's a very bad feeling that we have. But this is what happens during war. And hopefully, cessation of hostilities could come into effect as quickly as possible. Hopefully.
Can you provide any assurances here that this situation, that you will change course, that there will not be the kind of bombardment that we're seeing?
We will need to change course. But as I look at TV footage, I think Aleppo, eastern Aleppo, has been destroyed already. You know, I see TV footage where I don't see a single intact building. All that happened before
because
Russia
of Syrian and Russian bombardment.
No, come on, no. That kind of destruction you can see on television, cannot be caused by a few days of bombardment. This war had been going on for over 5 years, and the destruction you see in Aleppo, in eastern Aleppo, western Aleppo, in some other cities, is completely mind-boggling. And definitely it was not caused by Russia, because we have been there just a short period of time.
But you're continuing it.
Of course, because Nusra and ISIL continue to be there. And we agreed. That's very important to remember, that Nusra, in the Security Council resolutions, Nusra and ISIS need to be fought till they are defeated and destroyed. This is what we are trying to accomplish.
We live in unprecedented times, even to the point where, for the first time ever, the White House has accused a foreign country, Russia, of meddling in the U.S. election. Do you confirm or deny those reports?
They have not produced any proof. This is what Americans do. This is new fashion in town on various issues.
Just fashion.
This is what they do. They make all sorts of accusations without producing any proof, because it's fashionable now to accuse Russia. And because I suppose they think that it's an easy, answer one of the two candidates can give to difficult questions which are being asked from time to time. Instead of responding to a question, the candidate can say, well, but in fact, it's Russia which is behind the whole thing.
Russia's ambassador to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, speaking there with the BBC's Lise Doucette. Whatever you think about airport security, at least you can be pretty confident about the equipment used to look for weapons or explosives. You know the metal detectors and body scanners are real. They're not props. But what if you lived in a place where bombings are common and you found out that the security people there are using phony detectors? Rebecca Collard has that story from Beirut.
Car after car enters the parking lot of an upscale shopping center in central Beirut. The city has been hit by numerous bombings in recent years, so security guards go over the vehicles here with handheld bomb detectors. You do it like this, says Sami, a guard who doesn't want to give his last name. He points a long metal antenna at the wheel well of a black SUV. The device Sammy is using is called the Alpha 6. But what Sammy doesn't realize is that it's completely useless. Not poorly designed or not very effective, but completely incapable of detecting anything. Thousands of these devices were sold to governments and security firms across the Middle East and Asia. Essentially, it's just a black plastic handle and a metal antenna. In fact, they're modeled after novelty golf ball finders sold in this 1990s infomercial.
Anyone can find a golf ball fast with the Gopher, even a child.
The Alpha 6 looks almost identical to the Gopher. Just the logo on the handle is different. In 2014, the British couple that made the Alpha 6 was found guilty of fraud, according to this BBC report.
Samuel and Joan Tree were involved in an international scam that reached across several continents. It was here that they assembled their Alpha 6 devices in their garden shed.
Another British businessman, James McCormick, also marketed thousands of similar devices. Many of those were sold to Iraq between 2007 and 2010, years when thousands of people were killed in bombings of government buildings and shopping areas. McCormick is serving a 10-year prison sentence in the UK, but the fake devices he sold are still being used across the region. Inside the Beirut shopping center, I meet Ziad Nasrallah. He tells me he's known for years that the detectors don't work.
When I read the article, like 5 years ago, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, that it was a big scam, I expected all this to stop, but I was surprised it hasn't. So I figured maybe they upgraded them.
But they haven't been upgraded or replaced, at least not all of them. The companies and agencies that bought them should have been more careful, says Nasrallah. But he thinks they may have profited from the deals.
I think, you know, it's up to private institutions and people to be more vigilant about this stuff. But obviously they are in bed with them, you know, to a certain extent. Unless the security companies actually believe that these devices work.
Maher El Obeidi is the security manager for this shopping center.
We use Alpha 6. Uh-huh. I know there is a lot of talks about it, and it works, it doesn't work. But at least the police, they are still using it. The army, they are still using it. So we are using this machine, that's all.
Obeidi tells me he believes the machine works, though it's not perfect. If the guards are suspicious, he says, they bring in the bomb-sniffing dogs. But then he adds that with the way attacks are carried out these days, where the bombers are willing to die, nothing can be truly effective.
If somebody is coming to kill himself, how can you stop him? Expose himself, how can you stop him? As simple as that.
Back out on the street, we tell Sammy that the device is fake and that the guy who made it is in jail. I've heard that, he says, but it's not true. For The World, Rebecca Collard, Beirut.
You're listening to The World. Hip-hop was born and grew up in New York, but it's a part of Rio de Janeiro, too. A few years ago, Rio's city council officially recognized that. But now some activists in the Brazilian city are pressing for more. They want a neighborhood square designated as Rio's Hip-Hop Plaza. The World's Will Carlos has our story.
26-year-old Snoopy Criolo spits a few lines accompanied by MC Mingão.
Fome de progresso em vida ativa, minha forma inativa, me vejo tão superada e mente participativa.
This performance isn't taking place in a club, a studio, or out on the street. We're in Rio's ornate city council chambers. A group of rappers, DJs, and activists mingle with dark-suited politicians. They're all talking about the project Snoopy and his friends are here to promote.
Nossa intenção hoje trazer as gerações mais jovens.
That's DJ TR from the Cidade de Deus, or City of God neighborhood. He says he and the others are here to launch an effort that will teach Rio's young people that hip-hop isn't just about having a party. They want the city council here to dedicate one of the city's historic squares as Rio's Hip-Hop Plaza, and they have their eye on a square that's already being renovated in a downtown neighborhood.
Rio already has other plazas dedicated to famous musicians and public spaces like the Cidade da Samba, where samba schools can practice for the Carnival parade. But TR says there's nothing in the city that celebrates hip-hop as an element of contemporary black culture. So he's enlisted the help of City Councilman João Mendes de Jesus.
O mesmo queremos fazer para o hip-hop.
We want to make a space that sheds light on the hip-hop movement as a part of the culture of this city, he says. Mendes already sponsored a city law that recognized hip-hop as part of Rio's cultural heritage back in 2012. Securing a space for graffiti artists, breakdancers, rappers and DJs to do their thing is just the next phase in giving recognition to these art forms, he says. The square would have performance spaces as well as regular concerts, including an annual festival celebrating Rio's official day of hip-hop, November 12th. Underlying all this effort is something deeper. Snoopy raps about the inequality facing young black Brazilians in Rio de Janeiro today. He talks about the violence, which he calls a genocide. In a city where young black men are overwhelmingly the victims of shootings by gangs and by the police, there's a broader goal to legitimize hip-hop as an accepted and valuable art form, says Bruno Rafael. We saw that young people didn't know, he says. They didn't realize that hip-hop is a culture that can rescue them. In Rio's toughest neighborhoods, he says, many young black men have few options. TR and Bruno credit hip-hop with giving them a creative outlet that got them through some hard times. It's still early in the process, but they see the designation of a public square as a way to show the broader city of Rio de Janeiro that this art form, created primarily by young black men from the favelas, is something worth preserving and respecting. For The World, Will Carlos, Rio de Janeiro.
Will shot a video of MC Snoopy Criullo and crew spitting rhymes and beatboxing. Yours to enjoy at PRI.org. We were talking earlier on the show about Bob Dylan's influence around the world and all the artists we've heard over the years who were inspired by Dylan to write their own protest songs. We're going to wrap things up today, though, with some global artists who've simply covered songs by the newly minted Nobel laureate, a kind of Bob Dylan historical discography in multiple tongues and cultures. After all, if the significance of a writer is measured in how many languages they've been translated into, Dylan does pretty well. So let's start with 60s Dylan. Here are Japan's Magokoro brothers, who took on Dylan's My Back Pages decades after he wrote it.
この世にはないと思っていたよ誰よりも早くいい席で景色が見たかったんだ僕を好きだと言ってくれた女たちもどこかへ消えたあの頃の僕よりあの頃の僕より今の方がずっと若いさ
The Magokoro brothers there covering in Japanese My Back Pages in 1995. Let's move past Bob Dylan's most political period in the 60s and head to the 70s. This is a song off of one of my favorite Dylan albums, Blood on the Tracks. This is Italy's Francesco Di Gregori with his version in Italian of If You See Her, Say Hello.
Se la vedi, dille ciao, salutala dovunque sia. È partita tempo fa e adesso forse in Tunisia. Ville che non si preoccupi per le cose lasciate qui. E se crede che l'abbia scordata, non dirle che non è così.
Francesco Di Gregori first covered that in 1997, but last year he put out an entire album of Dylan covers in Italian, a true believer if ever there was one, a man whom Dylan describes as a folk Italian hero. Okay, this takes us into the more recent phase of Dylan's life, years when he's riding on the reputation of his iconic songs from the early years, while still being commercially viable.
When the rain is blowing in,
Yeah, there are probably young listeners who don't even realize it, Bob Dylan wrote, Make You Feel My Love. But thanks to his songwriting skills and singers like Adele, Dylan is still today cementing his legacy as a lyricist.
I could hold you for a million years to make you feel my love. But I will never do you wrong.
We'll leave it there today. Hey, it's never a bad day when Adele is singing, and especially when it's lyrics by a Nobel laureate. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
I'd go hungry, I'd go black and blue. I go crawling down the avenue. No, there's nothing that I wouldn't do to make you feel my love.
PRI, Public Radio International.